Everybody loves a Southern storyteller. Everybody loves a Southerner who can tell a good story. That tradition is something that I am very honored to be a part of. There is no place more suited to tell a story than the South.
That voice belongs to a writer from coastal Virginia named S.A. Cosby. Fans of crime fiction all over the world know Mr. Cosby for his gritty, high-octane Southern noir about crime, conscience, and the costs of violence. His novels, including this year's instant New York Times bestseller, King of Ashes, have made Cosby and his friends, just call him by his first name, Sean, they made him famous. The tradition Sean Cosby is proud to be part of includes the Southern writers who look without flinching into the darker sides of life. Familiar names like Alice Walker and Ernest J. Gaines. Sean also considers early Southern blues singers like Lead Belly and Son House and Robert Johnson as part of that group. And there's this one other guy who, well, I'll just let Sean introduce him.
My friend, the great, esteemed, what I like to call the most interesting man in the South, Ace Atkins.
Ace Atkins is the son of Alabama. He, like Sean Cosby, is a Generation X Southerner. Ace was born in 1970, and Sean is 3 years younger. Sean's first novel, My Darkest Prayer, came out in 2019 when he was 46. And he's published four more since then. Ace published his first book, Crossroad Blues, in 1998 when he was 28, and he has published another 30 since then. Now, Atkins played defensive end for the 1993 Auburn Tigers football team, and that team went undefeated, but famously could not claim the national championship because the NCAA had put Auburn on probation for recruiting violations. Atkins went from playing SEC football to writing about the sport for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. And then he took a job covering the crime beat for the Tampa Tribune. Crossroad Blues and the three novels that followed it were based on a character named Nick Travers. Nick is a former NFL player for the New Orleans Saints who stays in the Crescent City working as a blues historian and, let's put this phrase in quote marks, a part-time detective. Then Atkins began his highly popular Quinn Colson series about a rural sheriff in North Mississippi in 2011, with 11 books published through 2021. And I, being hopelessly addicted to the Quinn Colson series, am hoping that those books will continue. Atkins has also written five standalone books, starting in 2006. One of them, Let the Devil Ride, was a big hit in 2024 and is being developed into a TV series. And when the famous crime writer Robert B. Parker died in 2010, after writing 40 novels and part of a 41st about a private investigator named Spencer, whose first name is never revealed, the Parker estate hired Atkins to keep the series going. So between 2012's Lullaby through 2022's Bye Bye Baby, Ace has also written 10 Spencer books. Crime fiction is big business, if you haven't figured that out by now. It's a long tradition that goes back to Edgar Allan Poe and beyond. There are some literary snobs who look down on crime fiction, but Ace Atkins thinks those people are wrong, and I agree with him.
I always tell people when they say, like, oh, I don't read crime novels, I don't like mystery books, I write, you know, read more serious books. I said, look, the limitation of a crime novel is in the hands of the author. The author can make it as deep and philosophical as they want to, but that's the skill of the writer. You know, that's not a limitation of the genre.
There are many crime writers, but Southern crime writers are a special breed. The greatest ones understand that when you unspool a mystery in the South, the present rubs up against history. Their stories dig into race and class and faith and family. And Ace Atkins and S.A. Cosby are two of that rare breed. Both of them are masters of a gritty subgenre of crime fiction, with roots in the work of writers such as Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. Hammett and Chandler's dark, moody novels inspired the great films of the 1940s starring actors like Humphrey Bogart. Unforgettable movies such as The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep, which French film critics of that era dubbed film noir, or dark cinema. And from that tradition has emerged the modern literary term Southern noir. And it makes sense, because after all, it was William Faulkner who wrote the screenplay of Raymond Chandler's book, The Big Sleep, where Bogart and Lauren Bacall generated so much heat.
Do you always think you can handle people like trained seals?
I usually get away with it, too.
How nice for you.
You will find lots of such snappy dialogue in the works of Ace Atkins and S.A. Cosby. But with his latest book, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, Ace changes the landscape for the story. This novel drops us into the Atlanta suburbs of the 1980s, and the main character isn't a sheriff or a private eye. It's a 14-year-old boy who is absolutely convinced that his mom's new boyfriend is a Russian spy, a KGB plant. Everybody Wants to Rule the World pulls its title, of course, from a hit song of the 1980s, and it's built from the Cold War paranoia of that era. Movies on VHS tapes, the way Gen X kids were half feral and wholly unsupervised. But underneath all that fun, you know, watching the Goonies and Red Dawn and Prince videos on MTV, Ace gets down to the question that runs underneath his best novels. Who belongs in the Southern story and who gets erased? When I first heard of this new book, I got an idea. I wanted to hear S.A. Cosby talk to Ace Atkins. After all, S.A., long before he became the most famous figure in Southern noir, had talked about his admiration for Ace and about how the two had become friends. So I extended an invitation to both men to join me for a discussion about Southern crime fiction, generally, and Everybody Wants to Rule the World, specifically. Well, guess what? The stars have aligned, and that conversation is what you're about to listen to. Two of the South's finest writers who have inspired each other with their work. Two writers who feel at home here on Salvation South because they insist on telling the South their way. All of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Two writers who are dedicated to the idea that for Southern stories to ring true, they must honor the diversity and the music, the violence and the tenderness of this place we call home. I'm Chuck Reese, and welcome to Salvation South Deluxe, a series of longer in-depth pieces which we add to our regular podcast feed. On Deluxe, we tell you stories about the South you won't hear anywhere else. And we do that by letting you hear the authentic voices of people who make this region unique. I'm just going to let Sean Cosby take center stage here. I'll just stay out of the way unless I need to clarify something for you.
Ace, for the folks that are maybe listening, tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us about your new book.
I'm a New York Times bestselling writer, novelist. I used to be a journalist. I worked for the Tampa Tribune for a number of years. And I mainly write about the Deep South. I write about Mississippi, where I live here in Oxford, Mississippi. But my new book is set where I lived as a kid, which is Atlanta in the 1980s.
This book is a little bit of a departure from some of your other stuff, not just the location and the setting, but sort of the tone, the protagonist, and so on and so forth. You're the author of the Quinn Colson series, which I love. That's how I discovered your work, and was a big inspiration on my work. This book is a little bit of a departure from that.
Yeah, this is a book that I've been thinking about for a long time. And, you know, you always hear that adage, which is, you know, write what you know. And I don't always do that. I've written about things that are different. I've written books that have been set in the 30s and the 20s and the 50s and involve a lot of research. But when I was a kid, I lived in outside Atlanta. I lived in the suburbs. My family, my dad was had retired from being a football coach, and he worked for the San Francisco 49ers, and we relocated back to the South. And it was a time that the best described living it, if anyone has ever watched Stranger Things, the TV show, it looked just like Stranger Things.
All five seasons of that smash hit Netflix series were filmed in Atlanta and its suburbs.
And even the mall that they use is the mall where I used to go when I was a kid. Everything looks just spot on. Being a Gen Xer, being a young teenager in the mid-80s, for me, it was a very interesting time with pop culture, with movies and books and TV shows. And, you know, we had, you know, Goonies was coming out. And, you know, I think about Back to the Future.
Steven Spielberg presents Back to the Future, a Robert Zemeckis film. Marty leads an ordinary life.
All these movies came out exactly 40 years ago. So for me, 1985 was a very pivotal year. And that's also about the same time, Sean, I don't know when you really got into books, but for me, that was in the mid-80s, and so much of it were spy novels. And everything, you know, the Cold War was just such a big deal. And the, you know, movies like Red Dawn, where we're thinking about, you know, what the Russians going to invade us sometime. That was just always on my mind. And so it was that's what I wanted to capture.
I was funny that you mentioned Red Dawn, because that's one of my foundational movies as a kid, as a man of a certain age. Oh, 50-something.
This is the emergency broadcast system. We are under attack by conventional forces of the Russian army. It is believed the lead were disguised.
But movies like Red Dawn, he took advantage of the, you know, the continuing, or the, I guess, the residual Red Scare in America. You know, we had, you know, the 80s was the age of Reagan, and Reagan was a virulent anti-communist, and entertainment sort of took on that perspective.
On the record of striving for peace, the United States record is one that the people should have confidence in, more confidence than the Soviet Union, which has a wrong record of violating treaties and of using subversion.
See, I was never targeted by KGB assassins. That did not happen to me in the mid-80s. But everything else, it just was the height. That period of time, you know, people watching MTV, and, you know, and I remember just waiting down the minutes until, you know, a new video would come on. So I really wanted to recreate that time period. There's several people I'd call the protagonists, but I think everything kind of spins off this one kid who's named Peter Bennett. He's a 14-year-old kid. His mother is a single parent. She's working hard at her job at this lab in Atlanta, and she's dating this new guy that Peter does not like at all and thinks there's something up with him. And very quickly we learn he thinks that this guy is a Soviet plant, that he's actually a KGB agent undercover. And so that's everything. If you know that, that's the whole book. You got a 14-year-old kid, his mom has got a new man, she's happy, and the kid, everyone thinks he's nuts because he said, this guy's not only bad news, I think he's a KGB agent.
The thing that I think I like so much about the book is it also takes in account what I call the subgenre in thrillers of the kid who knows too much. You see it in spy novels, you see it in horror novels a lot, you know, like Fright Night, and, you know, or The Lost Boys, where the kids are the ones that realize, hey, something's not right here. Yeah, you mentioned Stranger Things, and Stranger Things sort of is paying homage to that sort of subgenre. I really love not just Peter, which I thought he's a great protagonist, but sort of his team that he assembles around him. And, you know, the folks that are, you know, the outcast, so to speak, you know, the former pulp writer that helps him, and Dennis Hochner. And then, you know, the drag performer, Jackie DeMure, and these sort of ragtag sort of, it sort of felt like Peter was creating a supplemental family, if in a way, his family has obviously come apart. His father and mother are not together. Mom's got a new guy. Of course, that's going to make him, even if he wasn't a Russian agent, he still was going to have some feelings about it. And it felt like he was creating sort of this supplemental family or this secondary family. And I think that was really interesting.
No, I think that's spot on. I think you've got a good handle on the book, because that is a theme throughout, and definitely is the payoff at the end, as you find out, who is your family and who really has your back. But Atlanta was an interesting time in the 80s. You know, I found my new home. My family was finding these great authors and reading these spy novels. So Dennis Hochner is based on a man named Ralph Dennis, who was a pulp writer, wrote for Popular Library back in the 70s about Atlanta. He's a terrific kind of forgotten writer. And when I was a kid going to a bookstore, Ralph Dennis worked at that bookstore. At that time, I did not know who he was till later, but he had stopped publishing and he was just shelving books at that bookstore. So the way that happens in the book is exactly that it really happened in real life. Like with the Jackie Johnson, whose stage name is Jackie Demure, really in Atlanta at that time period, there was a big drag scene in Midtown Atlanta, which was a big part of Atlanta culture. That's where RuPaul got his start, and that's where that scene was happening.
This is what I made. It's hard. Let's see. It's actually was something I cut up, and it had sleeves and everything, and it had a collar on it. You know, I made it into an Audrey Hepburn too for the role dress.
In Everybody Wants to Rule the World, there is talks about tolerance, both racial and with Jackie Demure, more social, LGBTQ, so on and so forth. And I wanted to talk about that because the thing that I've always loved in your work, the thing that I've tried to emulate in my own work from, you steal from the best, is this idea of having a conversation about the South. Because to me, there's no place like the South. It is a magical place. And you really get that feeling in this book. So I just want to know if you could speak to that a little.
It's funny. We always have these people that show up when you and I are talking. We're giving these talks that just pop up for the Q&A questions. And they say the damnedest things. And last time you and I were talking here in New Orleans, is some guy, the old guy stood up. We were talking about the strength of diversity of the South. And he basically said, did you grow up in Atlanta in the 1950s? Well, I did. And we kept to our own neighborhoods. And everything was fine. Atlanta in the 80s, it was a huge transitional time because a lot of those barriers were being broken down. And so you also had just the idea of Atlanta. So many of the old Atlanta was physically being razed. So you had a lot of the old Atlanta being destroyed and the new Atlanta, the skyscrapers and everything coming up from that. So you had another, second Phoenix, rising from the ashes of Atlanta during that time, and it was coming around. To me, that's the South, where you just have everybody. You can't write about the South effectively of writing about only one South. I mean, the South is just a diverse place, and the way it's represented in media and often in film is that it is this white Southern world, and that's just a lie. That's not how it is. It is a very multicultural place, and that's what makes it so great. What's a city like Memphis without soul music? Or what's the Delta without blues? With the same kind, the Mexican community that brought in tamales, and it's just that's what makes the South interesting. And I think that does not get represented a lot in literature.
You had mentioned Prince. I know personally you're a huge music fan, not just Southern music and the Mississippi Delta and the blues and stuff like that, but there's a variety of music influences, and music plays a big part in my own writing, my own books. I've noticed that with Southern writers, we're roughly in the same age group, and I remember MTV and Prince and Michael Jackson, and who was better, and who, the bands that came out of that period of time, watching MTV, seeing a video, a mini movie, if you will. But also, I'm also a fan of the blues. I'm a fan of hip hop, and so on and so forth. And I wondered, the title of the book is based on a song by Tears for Fears, which is one of my favorite groups as well. So I don't know. I wanted to know if you could just speak to the influence of music on the story a little bit.
For me, I think every book has its own soundtrack. And I think you and I think about books very cinematically, because our generation cannot, you know, we're not in a silo that we're just influenced by other authors and other books. You know, we are influenced by watching VHS movies and comic books. And we have, there's never been a generation that's more inundated with pop culture than Gen X. I mean, we just devoured this stuff. And it was very, very important to all of us. You know, the second British invasion, where you had bands like Tears for Fears and Duran Duran. But then you also had, you know, Prince coming on, and you had, you know, I remember when the Thriller video premiered. I mean, what a big deal that was. I mean, the lead up until Thriller coming out, and then everybody, it blew everybody's mind because it was a mini movie.
It's only a movie.
It's not funny.
You were scared, weren't you?
And I do miss that. I think kids today don't have that shared experience, that cultural experience of everybody seeing the same thing happening. The last book I wrote, Don't Let the Devil Ride, had a very 1970s soul soundtrack. And it was very much inspired of the music of Memphis and Al Green and Ann Peebles and Johnny Taylor. And that's the feeling that I want for the book. But for this one, you know, a lot of electronic music, you know, stuff like Tangerine Dream, things that you would hear, that heavy synthesizer music that you'd listen to on some of those shoddy VHS movies. So a lot of that played into, you know, the feel of this book. I think that's what music does. It gives me, you know, I've got, you know, when I write Quint Colson, you know, I'm listening to Waylon Jennings and George Jones and Charlie Cried, and you know, that's the feeling I want those books to have. I want that to sound and feel like it. And so for this book, it was mid-80s all the way.
I definitely agree with that. Music is the soundtrack to each of my books, and each of my books has a different tone. You know, King of Ashes is very much Southern hip-hop, Virginia hip-hop, shout out to the Clips, who I love, whereas All of a Sudden This Bleed was very bluesy, very much Robert Johnson and Lead Belly and Sun House, but also more modern sort of blues and R&B artists as well. So I even make playlists up for myself for my books on like different audio platforms. And so music definitely does drive not only the story, but the dialogue, the rhythm of the book. I went to the
crossroads. Salvation South Deluxe will be right back after this short break.
You live in Oxford, Mississippi. You live near Square Books. I think you're the unofficial mayor of Oxford. As I said before, Ace is the most interesting man in the South. We all know that's the home of, you know, of course, Faulkner, but also Larry Brown is out of Oxford, Tom Franklin, you know, the great Michael Ferris Smith, who's a good buddy of mine. How has Oxford influenced you, as not just a person, you know, on a personal level, but as a writer?
Well, being in Oxford, that's a very good question, because it is, I don't think sometimes people understand how many writers are here. You mentioned some of my buddies, not just, you know, writer friends that I see at conferences or that kind of thing, but these are, you know, I see Tom Franklin, we go see movies together. Anytime there's a new comic book movie out, you know, Tom and I are going to the Late Show to go check out that movie. Michael Ferris Smith and I smoke cigars together down the street at the smoke shop. It's inspiring, you know, it makes you want to work harder. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you and I both like to go to the gym and work out. It's like, you know, you go and you want to be around, you don't want to work out with the weakest people. You want to work out with the strongest people. And so it's a real community. But I think what brought us here, you know, of course, is Faulkner. Well, I got here 25 years ago, and you know, I knew Faulkner in the way that you would know Faulkner from, you know, your English teacher, where you were impressed upon to read Sound and the Fury, and you were told to read Rose for Emily, and you were, you know, this is great, and you're gonna like this whether you like it or not. But I wasn't really taught to appreciate and enjoy Faulkner. And so when I moved here, I really did make a concerted effort to read, you know, almost everything that I could that Faulkner had written.
As a writer myself, visiting Oxford, I've only visited in the last 2 years twice, but I've enjoyed it immensely. There is this sense of the momentous when you're there, when it's, you know, you're talking about the writers that are still with us, but also the writers that walk beside us and give us sort of our ancestral understanding of what fiction can do. And of course, Faulkner's one of those. And I'm very lucky. I got to visit the grave and, you know, had a more emotional response than I thought I would have there, and understanding what not only he needs to writing in general, but specifically to the South and the type of writing and how this Southern fiction novel, the Southern Gothic novel, however you want to describe it, is a serious part of literature. Whenever I read an Ace Atkins book, whether it's a Quinn Colson book, whether it's a standalone, whether it's a historical novel, whether it's even straying into the, you know, the world of Spencer, there are things that I know I'm going to get. And one of the things I'm going to get is really, really exciting suspense and really what I call sort of plaintive violence that is real and raw. It's not the 30-page, you know, fist fight, so on and so forth. For those who don't know, but I'm going to bring it around to this, you know, you were an All-American in Auburn. You played college football. Your dad was a football coach. You were very well acquainted with the physical toll that violence can take on a body. And I was wondering, how does that influence your writing? The, you know, the actual understanding of the physics of when two immovable force meets a unstoppable object, so to speak.
I appreciate you calling me an All-American. I was not an All-American. I was not on a good team, but I'll take it. It's been over 30 years. You just get better and better in your memory. So, you know, I'm an MVP now in my mind. I think football, it is a good thing to be up close. I mean, it's a very violent game, and playing in the SEC is no picnic. I still have some injuries from that. You do this so well too, you know, like in the King of Ashes, when you talk about, you know, with law enforcement, how they actually act and the way that they are complex. They're not always good guys. They're humans that have their own motivations and are sometimes playing both sides. When I left Auburn, I went down to Tampa and I was a crime reporter for the Tampa Tribune. And every day I saw how violence played out, whether it was a shooting outside of a club, whether it was somebody, a domestic dispute, a kidnapping, just everything. And you saw that stuff up close. And for me, that's really what changed my perspective, where, you know, the ripple effects of crime. And in your books, that it's so prevalent and honest and brutal the way that affects people. As a reporter, I got to cover some things that were, you know, hard to even comprehend. Violence, and you got this in every single book you've ever written, is never neat, and it is not clean, and it is not, I think it goes back for our influences with Chandler and Hammett, where, you know, they took the violence out of the drawing room and put it into the back alley, and they put it in the hands of real people and real criminals. And I loved King of Ashes for all the realism and the bloodiness and the ripple effects of how it truly affects people's lives, physically and mentally and psychologically, and buried secrets. Those are the kind of books I like to read. I think often I will pick up a book where it does not feel real to me, does not feel like this would have really happened, and I just don't have time for it. King of Ashes, man, one of my favorite books of the last few years. I think this may be my favorite you've done.
Oh, man, gosh, thank you so much. I want to come back over to Everybody Wants to Rule the World, because I don't want people listening to think that it's, you know, it's this, you know, dour, sort of brutal. There is some violence, there is some danger, but again, it feels within the realm of the world that you've created of, you know, 85, 86 Atlanta. I wanted to talk a little bit about the protagonist again. He's not the overly precocious kid. You know, he's not, you know, Encyclopedia Brown, for again, dating myself for those out there who read those books as kids. But he's smart and he's charismatic. And I think he is, for me, what I take from him is he reminds me of the, again, going back to comic books, he's maybe not the hero that you may want, but he's the hero we deserve in this book. How much of you at that time is in Peter on a personal level? How much is Peter, you know, a little ace, so to speak?
I think Peter is pretty spot on of me of that time period. He probably is a little bit more adventurous, a little bit more cunning. Peter's pop culture interest, you know, reading these spy books that he was, you know, with John le Carré, Martin Cruz Smith, and Ian Fleming. That was me. That was me. You know, his, you know, appreciation of all things Prince. That was me. You know, loved Prince. Dex and Prince debate. Man, I would talk your ear off to tell you why Prince was so much better.
I never meant to call you when you sorrow.
So there is, yeah, definitely a lot of me in that character. In the 80s, if you were a teenager, part of the hustle was being able to find a ride from point A to point B to figure this stuff out. You know, I'd go to a buddy's house, you know, spend the night over his house, and we just take off, man, at like 11 o'clock, you know, and be gone, just walking through neighborhoods and going places to 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. Nobody knew where we were. Nobody knew what was going on. One of the questions my editor asked, you get those little notes in the margin, say, you know, where are Peter's parents? You know, where is his mother? Why does his mother not know where he is? I was like, there's no cell phones. It's a different kind of parenting. You know, once you got to be a certain age in the 80s, you were on your own.
People don't understand that when you were a certain age in the 80s and 90s, we were feral. We were on our own. The parents literally had to be reminded, it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are?
It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
It was a different time without cell phones, without surveillance, without find you apps and follow you apps and so on and so forth. I do think there's a sense of independent streak that runs through Gen Xers that comes directly from the world that we lived in. I remember being a kid and hanging out with my buddies and we lived in the country, so we're out doing stuff, blowing up pumpkins and, you know, and running through the woods and so on and so forth. And it was a sense of, well, you got to take care of yourself, you know, and be aware of your surroundings and so on and so forth. So I mentioned the Quinn Colson series. I love that series. I think Quinn is a really great character, a really memorable character in the Southern crime fiction pantheon. What was it that drove you to sort of delve into this time frame, this period of time, and this particular character at this moment?
I do like Quinn Colson because that's kind of the place that I'm comfortable writing. It's like my own backyard here in North Mississippi. I think there's more stories to tell. For writing a series, which is, you know, something that I had been doing for a long time, and not only was I writing for over a decade my own books, I was also hired by the Robert Parker Estate to do the Spencer books. So I was doing two books a year, two series, and they were completely different. One being set in Boston and one set in North Mississippi. So I had been on that churn for some time. And as you get older, you start thinking about those projects, like, when am I going to be able to write? And one of those projects for me, there were two major projects, and both of them I've now thankfully written, but they had been on my drawing board for a long time. One was about this private detective, Porter Hayes, who is a legend in Memphis. He had been around. He had been a cop in the late 60s, early 70s. He became a private investigator. Just every time I'd be in Memphis, which is about an hour from my house, I just kept on thinking about Porter Hayes. And I was like, you know, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to be able to write this character, create this world that I've been thinking about for a decade or longer. And then the other story was writing about growing up in the 80s and about a young kid who believes his mom is dating a KGB agent and writing about the Cold War. And I look at it as almost like a movie you'd see from Amblin Entertainment, this Spielberg company that would have been made in 84, 85. I wanted it to feel just like something you pull out of a VHS tape that you rented from your local video store. So those two books were very important to me. I enjoyed writing those books for the Parker Estate. I think it ended up giving me a broader audience and bringing me readers so I could write about the South and they would follow me along. I think it was a good thing. But at the end of the day, you know, I've got to write those stories that are important to me, that are on the books and on the board, the big board for me to tackle someday. It's hard. It's really, Sean, I don't know if you've had, you know, we talked a little bit about it's hard writing about the South right now. It was a different time when I started writing Quinn Colson in 2010, 2011, to what things have happened now. The South has changed. And I worry sometimes that the readership, the people who follow me that may want to look at the South in a certain way, that we're not going to be in agreement. And then there are going to be people who don't live in the South that maybe don't want to look at it because they think that it's all a homogenized place and it's an awful place to be. You know, it's the good, the bad, the ugly. And that's why writers from Faulkner to Larry Brown to our buddy Michael Ferris Smith, you know, that's what's interesting. It's like now all of America is the South. You know, we see all of it. You know, it used to be kind of contained. In my first Quinn Colson book, The Ranger, where I talk about this militia group, this racist white power group, you know, in the woods in Omaha County doing maneuvers. And my buddy Jack Kadarvis said, you know, yeah, you had them in the woods back in 2010. Now they'd be marching on the square. And I think that's where we've gone. I think there's been several steps forward, and now we've taken several steps back. And I think things that I think would have been culturally abhorrent and shocking 10 to 15 years ago are now going to be socially acceptable. It's a weird place where I'm in because I get people, I'm a big white guy, you know, and I wear a trucker jacket and baseball caps. And so people, man, I hear all kinds of stuff, you know, I hear all kinds of stuff and I have to let them know.
Yeah, you're right. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we'd been writing stories about militia movement. Now we're going to write about Proud. I'm going to be talking about Proud Boys. We're going to be talking about ICE. We're going to be talking about those things. But I think as artists, as writers, it's our duty. And especially as Southern writers and artists, you know, my favorite Flannery O'Connor quote, you know, is like, don't shake my tree if you don't, you know, don't want my fruit, you know. And so I think as writers, as Southern writers, it's up to us to talk about those things. You know, the thing I loved about the Quinn Colson book, especially when I first started reading them, you know, back with The Innocents and so on and so forth, was it was talking about a South that I recognize. And yes, the South has changed in the last 10 years, not always for the better. I think as Southern writers, as Southern citizens, it does fall on us to a certain extent to talk about it, try to understand it. You know, to paraphrase James Baldwin, I love the South. And because I love it, I reserve the right to criticize it. You know, to me, again, I mentioned earlier, the grandeur, the grotesqueness of the South, they exist dichotomously next to each other. And I think as writers, as entertainers, as you know, you see that musicians, you see that with poets, we are always trying to make sense of the South. But like you said, I think that's a good point. The South is the whole United States now. That we're maybe confronting some things about ourselves we may not want to. 85, 86, of course, we're not as progressive or socially progressive as we are. And in many ways, we've receded that in this time period. But there's a thing in that book that really struck me that, and maybe it's just the old softy in me, there's this sense of like really beautiful optimism in that book. You know, that yes, it's about spies. Yes, it's about the KGB. Yes, it's about the sort of funky, fun Atlanta of 85, 86, that era. But there's also this sort of optimism in the book that you felt. It reminded me how it felt in 86, 87 to be a kid in the South, to feel like, wow, you know, things are rough, but it feels like we're going in the right direction.
You talk about the optimism. There was I think we had a sense in that time, which is crazy. I don't think anybody 14 or 15 it's such a disheartening time. And then we've got leadership in America that is just so negative and toxic and everything against what, you know, you and I were brought up to believe in as far as truth, honesty, respect, the way you talk to people with class, you mean, all that stuff, you know, is just out the window. But there was an idea that younger people, I think, were going to change the world. And you think about something like, you know, you remember Live Aid in 1985, the idea that music was going to actually help people in Africa, you know, and that was going to raise money. And so you had the idea that pop culture was actually doing things that governments were failing to do.
You often talk about the New South and that New South that it's, I think, is still attainable. And, you know, I'll say this on a personal level, reading your books, they keep me optimistic because you are one of the writers that I look to. And I mean, just to be all frankness, as a white man, as a Southerner, someone who understands the South without denigrating it, who is able to discuss it without lionizing it, but also without making it detestable. We both do a lot of panels. We do a lot of discussions. We're invited to talk a lot. And, you know, there are times where you sit there and you're like, yes, I know how bad the South can be, but also, you know, I also know how good it can be and how great it can be and how, you know, there's nothing like the smell of magnolia trees. There's nothing like sitting around a cookout, you know, eating a sweet potato pie with your family. You know, there's nothing like, you know, passing a jar of moonshine back and forth on a porch with a friend that you've had since grade school. And so I think there's this sort of bucolic, sort of pastoral beauty to Southern living and Southern fiction that always has to be defended. It always has to be, that flame always has to be proffered. We always have to keep that flame burning.
As a reader, I am grateful that S.A. Cosby and Ace Atkins never shy away from talking about those things. Both of them prove that fiction sometimes tells us more truth than the facts can. And I would be remiss if I did not include this next piece from their conversation, in which Sean Cosby offers gratitude to Ace for some very specific inspiration. In 2023, Cosby released his fourth novel, All the Sinners Bleed, and it became a huge hit, landing on bestseller lists and a host of Best Books of the Year lists, and a 9-part Netflix series based on that book just went into production. And the main character in All the Sinners Bleed is Titus Crown, a black former FBI agent who comes home to rural Virginia to care for his ailing father and soon becomes his home county's sheriff. It turns out that Cosby modeled Titus Crown on Ace Atkins' sheriff, Quinn Colson.
Quinn Colson was a huge influence on Titus Crown. And if Titus makes a return appearance, which I'm being asked about, it's really because you were able to show me how to write a modern policeman in the world that we exist in now, where maybe cops aren't always doing the right things, and to show a cop, or show a sheriff who really does take that job seriously, who is, you know, taking up almost a Christian mantle of doing for the least of us. And a lot of what Quinn and what he's about definitely helped influence who Titus is. So I want to say thank you for that.
Appreciate that very much.
When I heard that, something important hit me. Both these writers are very careful about how they build their fictional heroes. Neither Titus Crown nor Quinn Colson is perfect, not by any stretch of the imagination, but they are always driven at the end of the day, or at the end of the book, I should say, to do right by the decent people in their communities. Doesn't matter how much money they got, or who they know, or what color they are. I treasure characters like that in Southern literature. They mean something. They have significance. And if I can get that from a novel that is delightful to read and impossible to put down, then so much the better. We would like to thank, first of all, S.A. Cosby and Ace Atkins for their time and cooperation. Both of these folks are very good people, and what a pleasure it has been for me to get to know them. All of us at Salvation South and Georgia Public Broadcasting are grateful to them for their time. We also thank Melanie DiNardo and Rachel Green for their help in scheduling all of these conversations. You have been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every week, we add a new 3-minute commentary about Southern stuff to our podcast feed, and every month or so, we add longer, deluxe stories like the one we told you today. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South Magazine, which you can find and read all kinds of Southern stories, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, everything at salvationsouth.com. Our producer is Jay Cook, whose knowledge of the Southern thing has become quite deep. We thank him for his dedication to making the Salvation South podcast a fine thing to listen to. Jake also composed our theme music. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell, and none of this could have happened without the support of two special people at Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sandy Malcolm and Bert Wesley Huffman. We'll be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast. If you listen to this podcast regularly, you know that it also features, in addition to these deluxe episodes, my short commentaries that air on the GPB radio network every week. So be on the lookout for two special episodes featuring the best of those commentaries in the year 2025. Y'all have a great holiday season.